For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
A lot of things that you say inspire me when I talk to other people and when I speak at school board meetings.
Hey, listening to you this morning has got my adrenaline pumping. You're like five consecutive shots of espresso.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for the courage to speak the truth. I want to tell everybody, turn on 990, because you know what? You guys need to hear the truth.
Barbara, that's my grandson, Bo, up there, and my granddaughter. Don't let him jump. Anyway, you know, we got to get on with this. First of all, the votes are in. They've been counted and verified. There's no ballot stuffing. There's no foul play. The only red wave this season is going to be a German Shepherd commander knocks over the cranberry sauce on our table. That will cause.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Good morning, Philadelphia. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the fabulous, amazing, legendary Chris DeGaulle, who is enjoying a well-deserved early vacation. And I'm thrilled to be here with my buddy, the equally vocally challenged Eddie Caiazzo. Hi, Eddie. How you doing this morning?
Good morning, Christine. I'm doing great. Great to see you.
Oh, it's so good to see you too. We didn't do our normal hug because, I mean, we could have. We probably, you know, our germs will celebrate alongside of each other because, as you can tell from my voice, I am still dealing with a cold. I don't know exactly what it is. It's not COVID. I mean, I had COVID already. I've had 87 shots. I'm immunized until I'm in my coffin, essentially. But I think it's just that respiratory thing that's going around. And, you know, Eddie, everyone was wearing masks, as you know, for the past couple of years. And that was supposed to have protected us against COVID, which it did not do, as we all know. And it didn't protect us from transmitting it to others, which we all know. You know what it did do, Eddie? It made sure that we didn't develop immunities to the other average run-of-the-mill viruses that are out there. That's why everybody's sick right now.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you lock kids out of school for 2 years, that's why they've been talking about what's going around in schools. It's just like, well, yes. Like, what did you think was going to happen?
Yeah, exactly.
After 2 literal years. But in Philly, though, the masks serve a purpose for the criminals as they get to suit up every day, put the mask on and then go rob people.
Or exactly.
Like, so they did serve a purpose for, you know, the criminals in Philadelphia.
That's right. Who was it, though, that said, I'm not even going to remember who this was. I hope it wasn't our commander in chief. But somebody said that masks, not using masks, is racist. Something along those lines about, you know, there's some kind of a, and I might be confusing it. There's so many horrific mask stories. There's so many horrible ways that people have tried to virtue signal with masks. They and, you know, I wrote so many columns at the beginning of the pandemic. Even early on, you just realize that those tiny little pieces of cloth that your 16-year-old quilted up in her arts and crafts, her virtual arts and crafts class, you know, with the I can't breathe on it or the cute little peace signs or the whatever, they did nothing. They were optics. They did nothing. Now, I will say, I was on the bus on Saturday, and because I was coughing and because I'm like patient zero typhoid Mary, I felt bad for the other passengers because they kept looking at me as if I had some kind of plague when it's really basically just the common cold. And I wore a mask because I wanted at the very least for them to think that I was doing something to protect them from, you know, coming down with whatever it is that I have. But I've had this for couple weeks now, and I can't shake the cough. I don't have a fever. Can't shake the congestion and the cough, though. It's just, I don't know. Does it make me sound sexy? Kind of like,
absolutely,
you know, Elizabeth Ashley or
yes.
something. It's like, yeah.
Well, but you and I are both, you know, over the airwaves, and you through the written word, you get to put out a column and kind of get your thoughts out there. I already put out there on social media. It's just like, I'm done. Like, we're not having friendly conversations at Thanksgiving and Christmas. Like, we're like, there's no, those people that you did wear the masks for, just be like, all right, listen, I know this doesn't work, but it makes them feel better.
Right.
I'm not doing that anymore. We're over that. That's all over for me.
I know. It's I totally agree that there was a column, and Chris probably talked about this. I think he did, by Emily Oster in The Atlantic, about, you know, well, we have to have an amnesty. We have to forgive those people who in good faith believed that pushing the masks was, you know, was for our collective welfare. Uh-uh.
No.
I'm not giving amnesty. I'm not empathizing. I'm not giving the benefit of the doubt to anyone, because I saw early on that this was being politicized, that this was being turned into, again, an avatar for virtue signaling. This was the way that we were able to sort of differentiate between the good people and the bad people. And if you were wearing a mask, even if you were hermetically sealed in your car alone with the windows up, you were a good person. And if you were brazenly walking down Broad Street, swinging your hips, and you know, you got your little earbuds in, and I'm not personalizing this at all. This, I don't know anybody like this. You're evil, because you're spreading your toxic illness, your infection, to the rest of the world. And it was a fallacy. It was a complete fallacy. And later on in the show, we're going to have the fabulous Ms. Robinson, Emerald Robinson, on. And we're going to talk about the farewell tour of Dr. Fauci. So I know many in the listening audience are as attached to Dr. Fauci as I am, you know. But you know, be that as it may,
I'm excited, Christine, for that.
I am too. I love her. I love. We actually have a great show in the 7 o'clock segment. You know, give you a little bit of a taste of what we're going to be doing. I have my friend, State Rep Craig Williams, is going to come on and talk about the upcoming impeachment of DA Larry Krasner. And he's one of the impeachment managers, the House impeachment managers. So he has a lot of good information, and he's a fabulous human being. So I'm really excited that he's going to be on. And we have Emerald Robinson, and then we have a couple of other great guests in the 8 o'clock hour. But right now it's just you and me, Eddie. We're just shooting the breeze as we make our way through our illnesses, our collective illnesses. Hey, how's baby Eddie? How's he doing?
Baby Eddie's doing great.
I Thank saw you. That picture yeah. you posted. You posted on Twitter with the two of you watching the football game. Oh yeah. My god! Oh my god! That is the most beautiful child. He's just like
you.
A perfect little person. He had a quizzical look on his face though when he was.
And like, that was the Commanders game. So.
He's like, Dad, you make me watch a game, my first football game, and we mess it up. Thanks,
yeah.
Dad. Thanks. Great childhood memories we're building together, Dad. Yeah, the Commanders. I just laugh about that. You know, it's the Redskins. I'm sorry. To me, they're the Redskins. They're not going to be another team. It's because it's the same team. It's not like a team that moved to a different town, and then like the Baltimore Colts will always be for me the Baltimore Colts.
Sure.
So when we play Indianapolis, I understand that it is now the Indianapolis Colts, and has been for the past 40 some years, I guess. But I grew up with Johnny Unitas, with the Baltimore Colts. I was born in Baltimore, even though I didn't stay there very long. So, but I do understand that that is a completely separate team now. And Baltimore has the Ravens, which is okay, fine. That's nice.
Yeah.
But the Commanders, it's the Redskins.
No.
Don't. It's like calling Bruce Jenner Caitlyn Jenner.
Don't be offensive.
I know I'm going to be offensive. I know.
No, I'm just kidding, of course.
I make an art out of it. I'm just an offensive person. You should have seen on Twitter, I don't know if you were following, I had I tweeted out something the other night in the wake of the tragic Colorado Springs shooting at the LGBTQ, the gay nightclub.
Sure.
I beg your pardon, people. And I basically said, because there were a lot of people on the left who were pointing fingers and saying, not only was this a hate crime, which it may very well have been. It may have been motivated by animus toward LGBTQ people, but we're going to talk about that in a minute. And there's a recent little twist to this, a little wrench thrown in that theory. But, you know, and this is the subject of my column in the Delco Times coming out this Sunday. There is a difference between motivation for a hate crime and hate speech. To me, there's no such thing as hate speech. There's hateful speech. There are insults. There are attacks that you can make on people. But the concept of hate speech is that if you say something, it's going to have an impact, and it's going to have the type of impact that occurred at the club, which means your words are going to trigger violence. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will eventually kill me. That seems to be the new iteration of hate speech. So on the left, there are a lot of people pointing fingers and saying, well, Republicans and conservatives have been making, you know, they've been opposing same-sex marriage. I mean, that ship sailed so long ago.
That's so 2014.
It really, I mean, even before that, you know, this is ridiculous. Obergefell and DOMA and all that stuff, that's gone. Now we're in the grooming and the trans movement and this and that. And they're saying, well, you know, it's horrible the way conservatives are talking about this. And it's making people, it's ginning up the anger and the resentment against sexual minorities. And then this is what happens. You have somebody go in and shoot up a nightclub. And I tweeted out, I'm tired of having people who are critical of sexual minorities, for whatever reason, even if they're insulting, having them equated with murderers. If you want to do that, take it to the next step and call Chuck Schumer and all of the people who are attacking pro-life activists, call them murderers too, or call them solicitors of murder, because they're the reasons that a guy went to the door of Justice Kavanaugh with the intention of assassinating him. They're the reason that we have churches being burned to the ground. Okay? Because if you want to do that, I mean, if you really want to take it to its natural extension, you have to, it goes both ways. And I tweeted that out there. And of course, I got a lot of pushback from, I don't even think it was people from the LGBT community. I think it was just people in general on the left. And they were saying, you're wrong and this and that. And then it devolved into, I can't say it on this,
sure,
on these airwaves, but people making sexual comments against me and things that they would never, ever dare say against, let's say, a progressive woman. But also, these are people who are talking about the need for kindness and tolerance and acceptance. And they've morphed into exactly the thing that they've criticized.
Yes. Oh, I'd love to get your take on a clip from MSNBC that Frank Figaluzzi. He says that these kind of words that you're talking about, this hate speech, is punishable in the court of law. Lauren Boebert, Tucker Carlson, he names them all. Can I play this for you?
Absolutely, please.
Prosecutors and police, they found quickly what they needed. That means they know this was a bias crime. This is likely, and since we've heard reports that the subject isn't cooperating with police, that means they likely found clear and convincing evidence on his devices. If he's a consumer of the people we just rattled off, from Lauren Boebert to Tucker Carlson, let's get it out. Let's get it out at trial. Let's expose it for what it is, name it and shame it. He's a consumer of these people, and those people should face civil consequences from the victims. The other thing they want to deny is not only the safe harbor, but the way we resolve this. And by that, I mean, you know, you asked earlier, how do we put a stop to hate? Well, one of the things you would normally do is teach young children in school. Here's what race is about. Here's these other people over here who may seem different to you. They have a different orientation. But you know what? Increasingly, states are saying, no. You can't talk about race or say the word gay or teach anything in school.
So first of all, of course, that was on MSNBC. secondly, there is what he is doing. He's not only saying that insults and that attacks on minorities, be they sexual, be they racial, whatever, are wrong, which of course they are.
I don't know anybody that thinks that. Like, I don't know anyone.
It's a straw man, right? Yes. It's a straw man to say that conservatives. What he's saying, though, is you must use our vocabulary. You must use our script. If you don't talk about these things, if you simply don't address them, that is the same thing as attacking, as dehumanizing, as demeaning, as going against. So if I don't talk about trans issues to a 5-year-old in kindergarten or a 6-year-old or a 7 or an 8-year-old before they even have any concept of sexual identity, you know, gender, all of those norms that they're talking about, if I don't do that, then I am the same as a person who is, you know, actually attacking and demeaning and insulting someone. And it's also equating wrongly someone who really has legitimate issues with exposing children to adult theories and issues such as trans, equating those people with people who would do harm to an individual because of their sexual identity. And you know, Eddie, his comment about civil liability, that's an open question. It is legitimate to posit that perhaps someone who, again, has ginned up anger against you because of your identity could be liable in a court of law. There are actual laws on the books. These are civil laws which could make you liable for defamation, false light. What's the word? There are a whole range of things that you could probably try and sue someone for. But to make it a crime, to make calling someone something an actual penal violation, you know, a crime, that's a whole different kettle of fish. Do I sound like my grandmother? Yeah, where'd that come from? Kettle of fish. Oh, Eddie, I'm getting old.
No, but it does not go both ways. All right. Of the nasty things that are said on the other side that gins up violence on the left are never punished. They're never talked about in the court of law. I think you saw something with Matt Walsh from the Daily Wire, that whole ordeal that's going on right now.
Just gonna address that, talking about civil liability. It should go in the opposite direction. I was right. So for those of you in the listening audience who aren't aware, obviously you know who Matt Walsh is, Daily Wire superstar, and there was an article in, what was it, the Daily Beast, I think. Did it appear in the Daily
Believe
Beast?
Believe so, yeah.
Online, some woman with 500 followers on Twitter, Lauren Sue somebody, I don't even want to give her any publicity, she wrote a column which the title of this column, and I don't know if the author was necessarily responsible for the title, because I could tell you that I don't write my own headlines for my columns. So she may not have been the person, but whoever it was an editor, possibly affiliated, you know, working for the Daily Beast, which had in quotations, this is the problem, it had in quotations a statement that Matt Walsh was only upset that more people weren't dead, and we're referring to the shooting in Colorado Springs, and they had it in quotations. That is defamation. That is pure defamation. You can get over the New York Times versus Sullivan standard of actual malice by just showing what they did. People on Twitter were saying, oh, he's going to have a hard time if he tries and sues her. I really don't see why. That's not my field of specialty. But I don't think you need to be an expert in defamation law to say that someone, even if it's a public figure, who is falsely portrayed as having literally said more gay people should have died, that person has a cause of action at the civil, you know, in a civil forum. He should sue. I tweeted back at, you know, he doesn't know who I am, but I tweeted back. I said, go for it, Matt. Make an example of these people. And guess what? The Daily Wire has the money. They can afford to sue. A lot of people who are defamed don't have that ability, don't have the wherewithal, you know, the resources to be able to file a lawsuit. They do, and they should. And they should force the Daily Beast not only to retract and withdraw that column or at least change the headline, but to issue an apology, which is something they do not want to do because they don't want to cede any ground
right
to the right, you know. But it is. It's outrageous. It's just ugh.
Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9. Now, more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for my great good friend, Chris DeGaulle. I have to laugh, just make one comment, Eddie. Late last night before I went to bed, which I thought I was going to go to bed early because I had to wake up so early this morning, but I can never go to bed. I was on Twitter and I must have said something about tune in, you know, on the radio. And, you know, like your old, the old big old RCA radio. I'm from 150 years ago. And someone had tweeted back, radio? Who actually listens to the radio? It's streaming, girl. And so Chris chimed in and he said something like, you know, stand down. It is streaming in these age, but he was like supporting me. So I tweeted back. I said, hey, I'm 60, you young whippersnappers. Sue me. I mean, people do still turn the dial, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Not just that. It's anywhere in the world. I mean, we have, my gosh, I'm on this side of the phone. So we have people in California tuning in way early in the morning. We have people in Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, South Carolina. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. It's yes, of course, all of Philadelphia, the greater Philadelphia area, South Jersey. But yeah, you can stream anytime online.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do.
And they're tuning in because of you and Chris. And I'm just sort of like, I'm piggybacking onto that. But, you know, over the break, we were talking again about the tragedy in Colorado Springs, and now tragically this morning we're all waking up and there is yet another shooting at a Walmart in Chesapeake, right, in Virginia. And we don't know very many details. We do know that there are 6 fatalities, some additional injuries. We don't know the motivation of the shooter. We do know that he was a former employee at this Walmart. We also know his identity now. I just saw on the internet, I'm not going to name the individual, but there is a photo of him. And what I really wanted to address, Eddie, was something that we were talking about before. Oh, by the way, you had a clarification to make, right, about the Matt Walsh thing.
So it's the Daily Kos, KOS, was the source. And it's available. You could see it in the news feed on Google. It said Matt Walsh only upset, quote, more people weren't killed, end quote, at club, takes highlight GOP hypocrisy. And that was Lauren Sue was the author.
Did they take the article down?
So when you click it, when you actually click it in the Google News feed, it just says retracted.
Ha!
Yeah.
You know, my thought is they got what they wanted, though.
Yes.
They retracted it, but the people on the left, the people who support what they were initially saying, are going to say, well, they were right anyway. I mean, they just had to pull it back because they didn't want to be sued. The damage is done. I remember as a little girl reading a poem called Words. I was in third grade, and I don't remember it exactly, but I just remember that there was this analogy with boots, heavy boots, that words that you use are like heavy boots, and that boots make deep footprints. And once you make that footprint, once you say that thing, you can't then erase it. You can't remove it. And they got what they wanted out of it. But speaking of the penultimate mass shooting tragedy in Colorado Springs, it is now has come out that the shooter, and I will not name the person, now identifies, according to his defense attorney, as non-binary and wants to use the pronouns they, them. Now, that's really thrown a wrench into things because the narrative of the white, hetero, cis, and probably Christian nationalist man who went in to shoot up a gay club because he hated the LGBT community has just been undermined by the fact that the shooter now wants to define as a self-identify as a member of the LGBTQ plus whatever community. And I was watching last night when this news broke on CNN, because I just cannot bring myself to watch MSNBC. CNN is kind of like, I don't know, CNN is like the flu. MSNBC is diphtheria or the plague. So I can deal with the flu. I can't deal with diphtheria. The scroll came out that the shooter identifies as non-binary. And Eddie, guess what the reaction was? Guess what the initial reaction was on the part of the panelists around the table?
Uh-oh.
Well, there was that kind of like frozen in the headlights deer look. And then they're very good. They're like cats. They can fall from a window and land on all four little paws because they recovered very quickly. Do you know what the reaction then became? It was, oh, he's probably doing this as some kind of defense tactic so that people will think that, will empathize with him and maybe start thinking that, well, you know, he did this because he was troubled, because he was bullied, because of his identity. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, were they just questioning someone's self-identification as non-binary? Were they actually not honoring someone's self-identification as a member of the LGBTQ questioning ABC plus community?
Christine, I think you found a snag in their logic.
Huh. And I'm not that smart. It's pretty obvious, you know? It's pretty obvious. So it's one thing for them to make fun of Caitlyn Jenner because she's a conservative, right? It's one thing to do that. And it's wrong. It's mean. I kind of did it at the beginning of this show, though, didn't I? Because I said something. I really like Caitlyn Jenner. I actually really like the fact that she's, you know, I mean, she's who she is, but she's a conservative, kind of a squishy conservative, but still a conservative. But they're actually coming out and saying, we don't believe that this person who says that he is non-binary is actually non-binary. I mean, this is setting a precedent here, Eddie. So the next time someone that they don't like for other reasons, because they're mucking up the narrative for them, says something that they don't like, they'll be able to actually challenge them. Are we allowed to do that? Are conservatives allowed to do that?
No, and sadly, like, you got that, like, and people can only hear those pearls of wisdom here, right? With CNN, nobody's really going to remember it because nobody really watches it.
It's true.
So, yes.
We have a much wider listening audience viewership than CNN. Now, I really was shocked, though, when I saw that last night. I figured, I knew that it was problematic for them. And listen, guess what? It may very well be, I can say it, it may very well be a ploy on the part of this defense. I have no sympathy whatsoever for this monster, for what he did. Oh. I don't care what pronouns he decides he wants to use. He's a murderer.
Yes.
Or at least, no, he's a murderer. I'm taking off my lawyer hat right now. I don't care about reasonable doubt. He went in there, there were witnesses, and he, in cold blood, murdered people. Now, query, is this because he hated gay and lesbian and trans people? We don't know what the motive is. And yet people are ascribing these motives to him because of the nature of the victims or of the venue. Do you remember the Pulse shooting a few years ago? The Pulse nightclub shooting in Florida?
Very tragic.
It was tragic. And the narrative was, out of the gate, it was he hated gay people because it was a gay club. Turns out the person was not motivated by homophobia. He was motivated by a hatred towards the United States because he was a Muslim American who was upset about foreign policy decisions that we were making in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria and Iran, bombings. And that was buried for the longest time because, again, the left wants to exploit these things and they want to turn the right into these avatars, these examples of fascism, bigotry. I mean, I was called a fascist bigot so many times the other night. I just started tweeting back, yawn, 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 yawn. But, you know, it just...
Well, because they
found
hurl,
that fascinating.
They hurl these accusations and they hurl these words, but they don't. What social media has done, sadly, it's literally taken the meaning out of some of the words. So it's just easy for someone instead of debating you intellectually, it's easy to just say, it's just like, well, you don't agree that this was a hate crime. You don't agree this was a bigoted person. Okay, well, you're a fascist. It's like, okay, I don't. You're literally taking the value out of the word. What is a fascist?
Absolutely. It's the same thing with the word Nazi. When you use the word Nazi to define someone with whom you disagree, then you're really disrespecting, that's not even the word I want to use. You're defiling the deaths. You're defiling the sacrifice of 6 million Jews and 6 million additional victims of the Holocaust. So it's wrong.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Join me weekday mornings at 11 on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Ooh, getting jazzy with it. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle. I'm here with Eddie Caiazzo. And in the next hour, in the 7 o'clock segment, I'm really excited. I'm going to have my friend, State Representative Craig Williams, on. He is an amazing person. I'm not going to say former Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. My uncle would have beat me on the head for saying that, former Marine, my Uncle Louis. Former prosecutor with the U.S. Marine Corps. Former federal prosecutor as well. And currently serving the good people of Delaware and Chester counties in his district. He is just an exceptional human being. He's married to someone even more exceptional who Jennifer Williams, who was the acting U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. And I was very, very proud to have once litigated a case against her. I can't even say against her. She was the prosecutor in a case where I was defending an immigrant. And I cannot tell you my impression of government prosecutors was so that day when I was in the courtroom before her and Judge Harvey Bartles, I believe it was, she acted with such dignity, such grace, such a desire to search for justice as opposed to just getting a scalp or a notch on her prosecutorial belt that I realized that she's exactly the type of person that exemplifies the best in our criminal justice system. But yeah, she's married to Craig. and he's a pretty great guy too. So you'll be hearing from him. He is one of the three House impeachment managers in the impeachment of Larry Krasner. And I'm really excited to talk to him about the process and whether he thinks that there is going to be a trial in the Senate. I was reading some materials about the Larry Krasner's reaction to being impeached. And as you can imagine, he's not happy about it. But what I think is particularly off-putting about his reaction is that he's marshaled around him his supporters so that they can advance this narrative that the impeachment, that House Republicans are conducting this impeachment because they hate black and brown people, that they're going against black and brown people because those are the overwhelming supporters of Larry Krasner. They are the ones who poured out in droves to vote for Larry Krasner. They and obviously white progressives in the city of Philadelphia. I would say that his reelection was not overwhelming because I think – I don't even know, Eddie, but far below 50% of the eligible voters actually voted in that last election. So it was, yeah, there was no mandate. It was just the people who were able to pull themselves out of bed, you know, to go to the polls were the ones who put him over the top. But, you know, let's be honest. If you're a Democrat in the city of Philadelphia, you're going to win. It's very, very rare. The last Republican – that I believe held the office of district attorney was Ron Castile. And I was just out of law school when former Supreme Court Justice Ron Castile, I believe he's retired, was elected as district attorney in Philadelphia. So, I mean, Larry Krasner, if you've got the label Democrat, you're going to win. But he's out there surrounding himself with people and saying, for example, here's a quote from Nicholas O'Rourke, an activist with the Working Families Party, which is sort of an offshoot of the Democratic Party, just much, much more woke. I call it the Woking Families Party. He says, quote, "This is what happens." He's referring to the impeachment. "This is what happens, the circus impeachment, when you try to defend black people," end quote. And I kind of chuckled when I heard that, you know, thinking about how well Larry Krasner is defending black people who are dying in droves in the streets of Philadelphia. They are the primary victims of the policies that this impeachment is aimed at, I guess, attacking or examining. And Krasner comes out and says, "This is an illegal impeachment. You only impeach people when they've committed crimes." No, he's wrong on that point. You don't have to have actually committed a crime in order to be impeached. And Representative Williams, Craig, will explain that to us. You know, what do you need to have done to have earned yourself an impeachment? It is true that it is unprecedented that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is impeaching a prosecutor, but Larry Krasner has committed some unprecedented errors in office, malfeasance, you know, violation of his duty to the public. And so I just find it interesting that he's hiding behind the black and brown community, as he calls them. He's using them to sort of, they're like human shields for him. You know when the Palestinians used to, you know, place terrorists in homes where, in communities where there are a lot of children, so that they wouldn't be able to, so that the allies would not bomb them, they'd hesitate. Well, that's what Larry Krasner is doing. He's surrounding himself by the human shields of the black and brown activists. You notice, though, that these activists are not the rank and file African American and Latinos and Asians who are living in these communities that are being essentially destroyed by his policies. So Craig will be with us very shortly after the next break, and I'm very much looking forward to asking him about the upcoming impeachment. What do you think, Eddie? It's going to be good?
Yes. I myself have many questions, because me personally, we're right up against the top of the hour. Me personally, I don't see how this ends in Krasner's removal.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'm excited for the action being taken, but yeah. I'm still a little pessimistic about the result.
Well, it's Pennsylvania, not Philadelphia. And we will be back in just 1 minute.
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. WNTP Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Chris, good morning. Love your show. You and Eddie is a dynamic duo.
I have a very hard time finding any news source that I can trust, so I'm very grateful to have this listened to on the way to work.
We don't have a crisis of lawlessness. We don't have a crisis of crime. We don't have a crisis of violence. And that is a category that includes gun violence, but it also includes some pretty horrible stuff, like rape committed without a weapon, or like a stabbing.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle, who is enjoying the beginning of his Thanksgiving holiday, and something that we will be enjoying, you and I, Eddie Caiazzo, tomorrow. Hopefully we'll be a little bit healthier. And well, I've been looking forward to this segment all morning, and I'm really excited to have as a guest, my friend, my good friend, State Representative Craig Williams. Craig just won his second term in office. He's the representative in the 160th district in the legislature in Harrisburg. I wish he was my representative. I am in Delaware County, or my home, my ancestral home is in Delaware County, but not in the townships or the area that he covers. But it's just good to know that he is representing the good people of his district. And, you know, he ran on his past good works, his service to the community, his successful attempts at getting funding for more gun prosecutions, which is key, which is very relevant to the discussion that we're going to have about the impeachment of Larry Krasner. Addiction prevention, addiction rehabilitation programs. And so, I mean, this is the real deal. This guy is a Marine. I keep saying, I don't want to use the past tense. He is a Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. Former federal prosecutor. And I am very proud and happy to be able to call him my friend, Representative Craig Williams. Welcome to the program this morning.
Good morning, Christine. Good morning, Eddie. It's good to be with you.
Great to have you here, and excuse both of our voices, because I think we're both going to be talking to you. But we both have non-COVID, non-fatal common colds. And so I'm going to hopefully cough my way through this interview. So the reason that I had asked you to come on, well, first of all, congratulations on your win. That's fabulous.
Thank
you. Wonderful. And you actually helped. Your seat was a key seat, as WHYY noted in an article that appeared after your victory. The Democrats were looking at your district, at your seat, as key, as crucial in being able to gain the majority in the state house. And they were not able to do so. And I, obviously you are a big part of that. So congratulations. Can you tell us a little bit about how you felt? What was this campaign like as opposed to your first term, your first run?
Yeah, it was quite a bit different. Of course, running in the midterm rather than in a presidential cycle changed the narrative a bit. At a time when I thought this race for re-election was going to be, about my lifetime of service in the Marines and the Department of Justice, it turned out predominantly to be about Dobbs and the Supreme Court decision relative to abortion. So, the narrative was different. The temperature, I would say, was just as high as it was in 2020. But notwithstanding that, I won by three times the margin that I did in 2020, in part because, I'm a father of four in Garnet Valley. I even after leaving the Marine Corps, I just came home and resumed service at a local level with Boy Scouts and, baseball and football coaching. And that kind of, selflessness, a sense of commitment to others, that messaging burned through in what is otherwise a politically hostile environment.
I think that's a great point, too. Also, the single-mindedness of your opponent in making abortion, as you noted, sort of the keystone of her campaign, was a mistake. It may have worked in other parts of the country, but the people of Pennsylvania, particularly your district, are more focused on bread and butter issues, or more focused, I think, on economies, or more focused on public safety, are focused on the things that they deal with every day. And while abortion clearly does impact women and impact a lot of people, in some ways, it's become a psychological cudgel. It's more of an ideological thing than an actual, a pragmatic issue. So I think that it was a mistake on her part. And I'm glad because, obviously, I think that you are much, much better a servant. You have the qualities and qualifications that your district needs. So congratulations.
Thank you. And they ran an ideological, bitter, attacking campaign trying to paint me as, some sort of conservative boogeyman, like other people in the state, or likening me to other folks. And it just rang hollow with our constituents, because in 2020, during a pandemic, we knocked on 11,000 doors. And this last year, we knocked on 9,000 new doors. So 20,000 doors in two campaign cycles, people knew who I was, and they were not willing to buy the characterization that they offered, which, again, was generic and inconsistent with the person that my voters knew.
Yeah, I think that's important. As you said, your voters knew who you were. And Deddy and I, during the break, were talking about media manipulation, how the media is not only able to, but quite willing to take a narrative and twist it whatever way they think is more advantageous to them. It's no longer the days of Walter Cronkite. And for those of us in the Philadelphia area, John Facenda, who was sort of our local Walter Cronkite, the person that you could really trust. Right. We used to call John Facenda the voice of God because he had this amazing voice. But it is true. And I did see that. I saw that in your race. I saw that in so many of the local races. And fortunately for you, it didn't work. Unfortunately, for some other truly good, solid candidates, it did work. And so, the Fourth Estate is actually I'm not a conspiracy theorist by any stretch of the imagination, but the Fourth Estate is weighing in areas where it should not. It's not asking questions. It's giving answers, or giving the answers that it wants.
Right.
So really the main reason that I wanted you on today, and I thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule. I know what you're up against right now, is to talk to us a little bit about what's going to happen going forward with the impeachment process. You're one of the House managers. There are three House managers, two Republicans and one Democrat. Who are your colleagues on among the impeachment managers?
Right. So you have the composition right. It's me and Tim Bonner from out in the western part of the state, and Jared Solomon from Philadelphia, who's representing the Democrats and who I assume will be offering the defense of the district attorney.
Okay. All right. So what's your timeline with this?
Well, so it was only about a week ago that the speaker gabbled in on a Thursday morning and named the three of us as the impeachment managers. And I should probably back up to say that, you know, this is a very deliberate transition in both the narrative and conduct of the case. So, you know, the House has now impeached the district attorney. That's tantamount to an indictment or a charging instrument. And we now move beyond this impeachment phase into the trial phase. And for that, the speaker chose two people who had really nothing to do with the impeachment process, nothing to do with the impeachment investigation, and who had a wide experience in prosecution. And you kind of alluded to it at the outset. You know, I spent a career in the Marine Corps, 28 years. I flew in the F-18 during the Gulf War, and after combat service, went to law school while on active duty and became the chief prosecutor of Camp Pendleton, the biggest base in the Marine Corps. And then later in my Marine Corps career, served as deputy legal counsel to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, doing terrorism, detainee, and ethics work. And then ended up in the Department of Justice, both in Denver, Colorado, and in Philadelphia, doing violent crime, gun crime, drug crime, and a host of other things. So I've been a federal prosecutor. I've been a Marine Corps prosecutor. It's kind of been the staple of my professional diet, and the same with Tim Bonner, who was nearly 10 years in his district attorney's office. So this impeachment trial will move along now like a prosecution by two prosecutors. And, you know, my understanding from a brief conversation with the speaker yesterday in Harrisburg is that we will walk the articles of impeachment over to the Senate next week when they gavel into session. And I believe there'll be a formal presentment on their floor of the articles of impeachment.
I like the fact that you gave us your background, because I think it's important for people to understand. And this goes against, again, the narrative of the media, particularly in the Philadelphia area, that this is a political prosecution. This is a prosecution, and these are real prosecutors who are in charge of the process here. This is not some ambush that the legislature is trying to exact or to, you know, to to do against the district attorney. And I also, I found it interesting, you said that you spent 28 years in prosecution at different levels, and that your focus was on gun crimes and drug offenses. And those two things, particularly the gun aspect, play very profound roles with respect to why Larry Krasner was impeached. Can you explain to us what the reasoning was for this impeachment? Because he was out there the other day at a rally, Monday, I think it was, saying that he shouldn't be impeached. It's illegal. He hasn't committed any crimes. Well, is it absolutely necessary that you have committed a crime to be eligible to be impeached?
No, it's not. And I do just want to correct one small thing. I was in the Marine Corps for 28 years. I flew for about seven of it. So it's been, 20 plus years that I was in prosecution and or legal work. But no, the Article 6, Section 6 of the Pennsylvania Constitution requires for an impeachment misbehavior in office. And that's it. It doesn't say high crimes or misdemeanors like our federal constitution does. It says misbehavior in office. And the articles of impeachment, and I want to be careful here because, just like a prosecution, I don't we won't be diving into the evidence and talking about the proof of our case. That would be unfair to the other side. But I can talk about the charging instrument, the articles of impeachment, and they set out things more than a philosophical or a political difference about how the district attorney's office is being run. Having been a chief prosecutor, I can promise you that, you know, I would be all about deterrence and safety and making sure that there was an absolute presence on the street. But the philosophical disagreement is not the gravamen of the articles of impeachment. It is being untruthful to the grand jury in a case involving a police shooting, being untruthful to the courts, being in contempt of the House with regard to subpoenas, completely disregarded a request for information from the House of Representatives, which we're constitutionally allowed to ask for. So there are, of the seven articles, several that talk about actual instances of misbehavior while in office. And the House of Representatives constitutionally is the only one with the power to impeach, and the Pennsylvania Senate is the only one with the power to then try the case, with the sole remedy being removal from office.
And thank you for clarifying that. For a lot of people who are lay persons, and there are even some attorneys who are lay persons when it comes to the whole impeachment process. When you hear impeachment, you think, okay, that means someone's been convicted. And that's absolutely not the case. Impeachment, as you mentioned, is I guess it would be sort of like a grand jury presentment. If a grand jury finds that there is enough evidence to be able to charge someone, this is more like getting a true bill from a grand jury than it is an actual conviction. You mentioned that there are, again, the three of you are the managers, but you mentioned that Jared Solomon, Democrat from Philadelphia, will likely, although you can't speak for him, will likely provide the defense for the district attorney. So how are you working? Are you working together? Are you each working separately and then you'll caucus at the end of a particular process? Or how does that actually work, that you will be putting together the evidence to present to the Senate?
We actually haven't had a conversation about it, in large part because our legislative sessions go from November 30th to November 30th every 2 years. So, you know, and the House of Representatives comes to a constitutional end at the end of November. So in 7 days, a week from today, our constitutional legislative session ends. And now there's an open question about who will be the next speaker and whether or not these three managers will be reappointed by the next speaker. So we're about to go into a little bit of procedural limbo, mm-hmm. although we will continue preparing the case on the prosecution side. And then once we have some clarity about what the trial team will look like going forward, then we'll start executing a little bit of coordination. But I did want to, you know, when we have a moment, get back to some of this work that we've been doing in the House of Representatives on gun violence.
Yeah, please. I want you to address that. That's really important.
Yes. Yeah, so, and it started when I was in Denver, Colorado, and the U.S. Attorney's Office there as a federal prosecutor, and then continued when I was in Philadelphia. But I was what was called a dedicated Project Safe Neighborhoods prosecutor. There is a section of Title 18 in the United States Code that makes it a felony for a prior convicted felon to be in possession of a firearm, any kind of firearm, whether it's homemade or not. It turns out that in Pennsylvania, they have the same law. So to say that in a different way, if a person has been convicted of a prior felony established in court, they are then statutorily, both federally and at the state level, prohibited from simply possessing a gun. On the federal side, the sentences for that are rather severe. And on the federal side, there is no parole. So you serve almost all of the time that you are given in a federal court. And as a consequence of that, the deterrence of even gun possession is quite high. And we were able to ratchet down on violent crime in Colorado in the time that I was out there, just by being aggressive with what we call felon in possession cases. So, taking that experience to the House last year, I was able to get $1.5 million in the state budget in 2021 for a pilot program in Philadelphia and Delaware County for the DA's offices to hire additional gun prosecutors and fleet them up to the U.S. Attorney's Office as special assistant U.S. attorneys solely to prosecute illegal gun possession cases.
That's fantastic. And do you know if they – I'm sorry to interrupt you. I mean, you got the funding for them. Do you happen to know whether or not that funding was actually used to hire those special prosecutors?
Not all of it, but yes, it has been used. It started off in Delaware County. And through work with the U.S. Attorney's Office, they were able to start getting hires in from the city of Philadelphia. And in this last budget in 2022, we doubled the amount from $1.5 million to $3 million. So over 2 years, $4.5 million to hire additional prosecutors, you know, under my math, I think that should be getting us around 12 to 15 additional prosecutors. You assume a traditional caseload of, you know, 20, 25 cases a year. That's a significant impact on violent criminality in Philadelphia in particular. Because, you know, I've said my whole prosecutorial career that most felons are economists. They do the risk assessment, the cost-benefit analysis of whether or not doing the crime is worth the penalty. And when they start hearing that the feds are coming with federal sentences, I think you're going to see an impact on felons in possession cases. And bear in mind, you stop and frisk somebody, they have a gun on them, you run their background and they have a felony, they've committed a crime in that moment. Now, Larry Krasner has said that he thinks that simple gun possession cases ought not be prosecuted, and he hasn't been. I was hoping, and I think we're going to find success in the fact that removing these cases to the federal level is going to add a level of enforcement that's going to make a difference.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so clear. And that was, I believe, one of the reasons that Larry Krasner was impeached, because of his failure to prosecute gun offenses to the extent that they should have been. And I think, you know, he had a great deal of discretion in doing so, and he exercised his discretion in not prosecuting them. I remember there was an instance when your wife's ex-boss, Bill McSwain, stepped in to do exactly what you were talking about, to impose to charge at the federal level a defendant who had not been charged by Larry Krasner at the state level for gun offenses. And I think, you know, we saw that, and a lot of people, a lot of lay individuals, a lot of Philadelphians, a lot of those of us in southeastern Pennsylvania thought that's exactly the way to go. Take it out of the hands of local prosecutors if they're not going to be enforcing the law the way it should be enforced to keep the communities protected. So kudos to you for getting the money for the prosecutors, but also kudos to you for trying to shift the focus and the orientation of these prosecutions to a federal level.
And I'll add, you know, to that end, we also passed this last year a gun violence task force for the city of Philadelphia that, you know, I negotiated with the Attorney General's office, Josh Shapiro, whereby the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney, and the District Attorney of Philadelphia sit on a gun violence task force with law enforcement to review every single gun arrest to determine which of those three jurisdictions are going to assert jurisdiction over the prosecution, so that, you know, lots of eyes on every single arrest to make sure that, you know, law enforcement is being brought to bear and punishments handed out.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I wish we had more time because you, when you mentioned Josh Shapiro, you just you triggered a thought in my mind, and we don't have time for it, about, you know, the relationship of the legislature with the governor-elect. But that will be for another time. Hopefully I will be back behind this microphone, and we will definitely, definitely have you back, Craig. Representative Craig Williams from the 160th, the great 160th district in southeastern Pennsylvania, beautiful Chatsford, beautiful Pensbury, beautiful Brandywine area. Love your area of the state. And thank you so much for coming on today. And please keep us advised as to what's going on with the impeachment process.
Absolutely.
And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. And I just want to say to all of our friends who are driving today, please go to work safely, come home safely. We want you to be with your beautiful families tomorrow. The roads are going to be a little nutty today. Just be patient, listen to the radio, and get to your family safely. Take care.
Take care, Craig. God bless. Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle, and I am absolutely thrilled to have as a guest, she's a regular, beloved by this audience, Emerald Robinson, who is host of The Absolute Truth with Emerald Robinson on Lindell TV and frankspeech.com. She's on Getter at Emerald Robinson, and her Substack, to which I subscribe, which is fabulous and amazing, is filled with information that you will get nowhere else. And I am a huge fangirl. Emerald, it's wonderful. We've spoken before in the past and not often enough for me. So I'm really thrilled to have you back on the show. How are you?
Oh, Christine, so good to talk to you again. I'm doing great. Doing great. Very thankful before this Thanksgiving.
I was just going to say, anticipatory happy Thanksgiving. I am as well. There are a lot of things to be thankful for, to be grateful for. The left would not have you believe that there is a great deal to be thankful for in the United States, except for the fact that they, you know, allegedly stopped a red wave and turned it into kind of like a red trickle. But, you know, I have noticed that there is more gratitude and appreciation for what we do have in this country among my friends who identify as conservatives than those who are more progressive, who are constantly criticizing the status, the state. And I do immigration law. I think I told you before. So I'm surrounded by people who actually want to be here and who are thrilled to come to this place. And so it's very discordant when I listen to some of my progressive friends. I do have some talk about what's wrong with us because I'm usually around people who are telling me what's so wonderful about this place.
Right. They're spending all the resources they have and fighting very hard to become citizens. And you have, I too have some friends on the liberal side of the aisle. And this, it's always an apology, right?
Yeah.
For our values, apology for our freedom, that the people you represent are doing anything they can to partake in.
Yeah, exactly. There's always kind of like this, what can you do for me? I am entitled to this. This is my, it's all about rights. It's not about obligations. Conservatives tend to have this sense of duty, obligation, service. And on the left, it's more of, okay, what? How can you serve me? You know, what obligation do you have to me? What can you give to me? But you know, I'll be generous.
That's a great way to put it.
So, did you see the great Dr. Fauci's farewell tour? His last presser yesterday.
I did, and I tried not to choke. It bugs me that I have never gotten to really ask that man a question. They made sure that he didn't take questions from me in the briefing room. I tried to chase him down on the north lawn one day, and it bugs me that he gets to retire without actually ever being held accountable or adequately questioned. But I have hope in knowing that today he will sit for his deposition. and at least, you know, qualified people are going to get to ask him some questions about the censorship, particularly the COVID origins and other issues related to COVID. So that I am looking more forward to than his remarks yesterday.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And you've written extensively. You've been quite courageous in writing things that no one else would write about, including vaccines, including the mandates. And Eddie and I were talking about an hour ago about, you know, we're both sick. I have a cold. He has a cold. We're all sniffling. And part of that has to do with just the natural, you know, it's the season. But there's a heightened, there's a lack of immunity among children and adults now because of the masking that we had to go through for 2 years, you know?
And the separation.
Exactly. I mean, these kids, you had written something about, you had a piece about the basically the corporate media in trying to tamp down the results or the repercussions of their fawning over Fauci and the current administration's mandates and policies and lockdowns and keeping kids out of school. And what do you think is going to happen as we go forward with we're talking about we're no longer in the middle of the scary part, let's say, of the pandemic back in 2020 and 2021, but going forward, what do you think is going to happen with this?
Look, I'm really worried, and I'll tell you why I'm worried. I'm worried based on policies that were endorsed by G20 leaders in Bali last week. That includes backing the World Health Organization's Global Vaccine Passport, where they support restricting the free movement of people around the globe based on their vaccination status, and that can include any vaccine that they tell you should inject into your body, and at this point, whether it works or not. I'm also concerned about what they had to say about lockdowns and future pandemics, and it's very clear that the lockdown playbook has not been thrown out the window. In fact, it's still central to what they call their pandemic prevention policy. It even in some ways is relevant to their climate change policy. So I am concerned that there has yet to be any accountability. So there's no reason they won't do it again.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that they've sort of planted the seeds for this to become the new normal, that people have been conditioned into accepting lockdowns, into accepting mandates on vaccines. And I mean, if you can imagine us, people remember what we were like in 2017, 2018, 2019. We would have reacted with, much more, I think, reticence, violence toward any governmental entity telling us, you put this in your body, you have to do this, you have to stay home, you can't practice law, Christine Flowers, because you're not an essential worker, you have to do that. And after 2020, it just got, we were sort of forced day after day after day, almost brainwashed into believing that this was the only way that we were going to save our lives. And I do think people are conditioned more now to be a little bit more submissive and accept it as the new normal. And Fauci was just on yesterday saying, I hope, my last parting shot, no pun intended, is I hope you get your booster. This is going to be a yearly regular thing. Well, I mean, how many things are we supposed to inject into our bodies because the government tells us to?
Well, apparently an endless amount. And if you saw Karine Jean-Pierre back in the first press briefing after the G20 summit, she said at the top, and I checked to see if anyone followed up on this at all. She said, we're pushing with everything we have, I'm paraphrasing, to make sure that people get their round of vaccinations for this year. And that includes the flu shot and the latest COVID booster. But as we know, it's pretty much totally ineffective. And she said that was their focus right now as an administration. And no one even bothered to follow up or point out the fact that they're ineffective and you know, all the other. And like you said, I mean, what is concerning, and I want to get back to something you said earlier, is that I've noticed that RSV is running rampant. And as a parent to young children, that is scary because it's more, it's actually more lethal to children by far than, you know, COVID is.
Yeah.
Young babies particularly, my youngest is now two, so I wouldn't be as worried about it. But I'm seeing back home, I'm from a small area. There's not, you know, it's a small rural coal mining town. It doesn't have a big population. And I'm seeing a disproportionate amount of babies dying, Christine, of RSV. And I know that there's also the component where they just, you know, our immunity has waned based on the COVID lockdown restriction policies, the masking. But I asked Dr. Peter McCullough yesterday what was going on, because I feel like parents need to understand what they're supposed to do, because, I mean, it's just heart-wrenching to watch. And he did say that there is a component of this, besides the reduced immunity from the lockdowns and the masking, there's also related to the vaccine, and he explained it. I hope to have him on the show again next week so he can explain it in more detail to parents so that they understand how to best protect their children. And when I'm saying that and looking at what they've done to us, the fact that they're not sorry, they don't care. Yeah. It's part of their plan. And they sound like, based on what they all had to say at the G20 last week, they plan on doing it again. People have to start speaking up. What they did learn through the pandemic and what we all learned is how motivating fear is to make people compliant.
That's exactly right. It's very true. And I know you have to run, and you know, I wish I could have you for the next hour, but thank you for the work that you're doing. I love your Substack. I would tell everyone to please, you know, subscribe to Emerald. Emerald.db3.substack.com. And happy Thanksgiving, my dear. God bless your family. And hopefully I'll have an opportunity to speak to you in the future. Be well.
Likewise. Good to talk to you, Christine. Happy Thanksgiving.
More of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
So my message, and my final message, maybe the final message I give you from this podium, is that please, for your own safety, for that of your family, get your updated COVID-19 shot as soon as you're eligible to protect yourself, your family, and your community. I urge you to visit vaccines.gov to find a location where you can easily get an updated vaccine. And please.
Welcome back. This is the triple vaccinated Christine Flowers sitting in for Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. And I'm here with the great Eddie Caiazzo on the other side of the glass, not because we're sick. It's just the way this thing is set up, but we're waving at each other. Yeah, well, there it is. Serve your community. Be good to your neighbor. Get the jab again and again and again and again. And, you know, I had COVID back in April. It was not a very severe case of it. It lingered for a while. I had it for about 10 days. And I'm still, I mean, I think I have the only holdover that I have is I have a hard time waking up in the morning. And I don't know if that's just because I always had a hard time waking up, but it's even harder now. I'm a little more tired. But I honestly have to say, I'm really tired of this idea that if you don't get vaccinated, you're not protecting your community. Because I know the majority of the people that I know who've had COVID have been triple vaccinated, some of them have been quadruple vaccinated. So I think even calling this a vaccine is incorrect. Some people said it's really more like the flu shot. It's not like the polio or the, the diphtheria, pertussis.
The measles, mumps, rubella.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. The old one from the 60s.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop you from getting the thing. It's I guess it makes it less serious once you get it. But I'll tell you, I've known people who've been vaccinated and who've had fairly severe cases of COVID notwithstanding. So I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm not taking my advice from Dr. Fauci. It's and it's a shame because at the very beginning, back in March and April and May of 2020, I really liked him. I would watch him on TV. I loved that Brooklyn accent that he had. I loved the way he talked. He talked like the guy on the commercial, Big Louie, you know?
Yeah, Big Lou.
You know, sounds like it. You know, it's like every Italian talks like this, don't they, Eddie? Cagliazzo?
Yeah, sure.
We all talk this way. Absolutely. You know, now I'm going to have a hard time not talking like this because now I'm in my cousin Vinny kind of mode. It's like, oh, the little deer. Look at the little deer. You hit the little deer right between the eyes. Anyway, no, but I mean, Dr. Fauci he's not the villain that a lot of people make him out to be. He's not, by any stretch of the imagination, a heroic figure. I found out well into the COVID pandemic that he was criticized years before the pandemic because of his handling of the AIDS crisis, his monetization of a lot of these protocols and preventative measures and, you know, AZT and all of the things that were going on. He was sort of doling out favors to the people that he preferred, that he worked with. And it sounds like he just continued that whole process through the COVID pandemic. So I don't know. I have an overall negative view of Anthony Fauci now, which saddens me because he's Italian and I hate to not like any Italian. Nancy Pelosi. Yeah. Which, by the way, we didn't talk about her. Bye-bye. Arrivederci, Annunziata.
See?
It's like there are some things to be happy about. There are some things to give thanks for.
Yes. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi. Now, I don't understand. So is she off into the sunset for now? Like, are we – obviously, she's not going to be speaker. But, like, does someone like her just keep running, like, at that age?
Well, she just got reelected. So, yeah. You know, what is she, 82?
Yeah.
When she hits 84, God knows what.
So, what I'm saying is, in hopefully 2 years, we will be completely clear. It will be a Pelosi-free Congress.
I don't know. She might be cryogenically frozen and they'll thaw her out in a couple of years. I don't know. Speaking of which, did you hear about, it was on the cover of the New York Post yesterday, there were embryos that were frozen in 1992, fertilized embryos, okay? Well, you know, embryos. They were implanted into a woman late last year. She just gave birth to twins who, their embryos were 30-year-old embryos.
Wow.
So had they been born when their embryos were fertilized, they'd be 30 right now.
Oh,
it's crazy. Anyway. Oh, modern technology. The things that you can do. The things that are unfortunate that they do to us with the vaccines and what have you. I don't even want to get into the whole myocarditis issue. There's way too much to talk about. We don't have enough time for that. But I just, you know, arrivederci Fauci. Go away. Thank you for whatever good that you did. Shame on you for a lot of the other things that you did and a lot of the things that you advanced and made possible, the divisiveness in our society. It's almost like a chicken and egg thing. People say, well, did he cause it or was he the byproduct of it? I don't know. I think he helped cause it.
Oh, yeah, his ego.
He put a target on the back of people who really had an issue. So we will be back in the next and final hour with two great guests. This is Christine Flowers sitting for
Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. WNTP Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
You are a role model for the rest of the media. You really do investigative reporting and informative interviews.
I absolutely love your show.
Chris, greetings from the bright lights of Cherry Hill.
attorneys for the accused shooter, Anderson Lee Aldrich, say in new court filings tonight that the suspect now identifies as non-binary.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
Welcome back. This is Christine Flowers sitting in for the great Chris DeGaulle. I'm here with Eddie Caiazzo and with you. Thank you so much for keeping us company this pre-Thanksgiving morning. And that news bite, that sound bite was from Allison Camerota last night. I remember watching that on CNN. And again, the look of deer in headlights on the faces of the panelists around the table when they were discussing the whole hate speech, hate crime aspect of the Colorado Springs shooting. And when it, again, when it emerged that the shooter, the alleged shooter, but come on, let's be honest, the shooter identified as non-binary, they didn't know what to do with it. It was like, uh-oh. Wait a minute. Uh-oh. It was the same thing that happened when it was revealed that the attacker of Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, had been a radical leftist Trump-hating, at least up until very recently, dater of a pedophile. All of a sudden, it was like, oh, wait a minute. Okay. Nothing to see here. Look the other way. So it's, you know, it's all about the narrative. But in any event, I'm very happy to invite on to the show my really, really, really good friend and a friend to the show and a friend of Chris's and Eddie's, my friend Dan Cerucci, who is a PR legend. I mean, the guy's in the Hall of Fame, and he is, he has wide ranging ideas on everything from politics to culture to religion. And I thought that he was the perfect person to come on and just chat with me this morning. Hi, Danny. How you doing?
I'm fine, Christine, and happy Thanksgiving to you, and I hope you're feeling better.
I'm feeling fine. I don't have a fever. I can't get rid of this cough. It's settled into my lungs, and it's just, I can't shake it. Eddie says the same thing. It's just one of those things. I was talking with Emerald Robinson earlier in the last hour, and we were saying that a lot of this is because people, our immunity is much lower now because we hibernated for 2 years. And so we didn't develop any immunities against viruses, against germs. So that's why everybody's sick, including the little kids. Are you healthy?
As far as I can tell, thank God, you know, I get my regular 8 hours of sleep and I try to live a healthy lifestyle. So thank God, and everybody in my family seems to be okay going into the holidays, so we're looking forward to it.
Are you down, are you in Jersey, or are you down with your family and all gathered together around the table, all of the Cerucci's?
We will be at my son's place tomorrow. We will all be there in Westchester, in, you should pardon the expression, Pennsylvania. And
it's a beautiful area. Unfortunately, it's got some really, you know, some liberals have sort of invaded that area.
I saw somebody post on Facebook I don't know whether you would call it an emoji or whatever, a cartoon or a picture, and it said, I'm in a very bad place right now. Not in my mind, just in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I know. We've embarrassed We have failed the country is what we did in electing a corpse. I mean, it's you've heard of the Corpse Bride, the old the Tim Burton movie. We've got the corpse senator. That's like unbelievable, Dan.
And Pennsylvania also elected a dead person to office in one of the state legislative races, I believe it was.
Like a real dead person, like dead.
An actual dead person.
And
Christine, let's not forget, I mean, it wasn't just the election of Fetterman, but And this sailed under the radar, but you and I are particularly concerned about it, and we think we have a right to be. And that was the election of Josh Shapiro, as the next governor of Pennsylvania, which he really had neither in the primary nor in the general election. He had no opposition to speak of, okay?
Yeah, and, absolutely not. And he also had the help of the wind at his back from all of the media sources, including some conservative media who I think misrepresented in many ways Doug Mastriano. You know, he may not have been the strongest candidate, but he was not the Christian white nationalist threat to national security that he was made out to be by so many in the mainstream media. It's really a shame.
No, and we let us also not forget these scoundrels, these Republicans that stood so proudly boasting of their support for Josh Shapiro and also calling themselves at the same time Republicans while they supported a man who supports some of the most radical and progressive radical policies, it's the same thing, including, you know, like abortion up until the time of birth. And
it's true,
persecuting
Dan,
the Catholic Church.
You make a great point. It's optics. John Fetterman is obviously a radical progressive liberal and looks the part. He doesn't look like, you know, hail fellow well met. He looks like a radical. Tattoos, hoodie, this and that. Josh looks like this little schoolboy with the pocket protector, you know, with his little wire-rimmed glasses and his smiley face and his acceptable, his little Montgomery County cred, and he's a moderate, and, oh, we can trust Josh and pat him on the head, and I beg your pardon. That's the danger, because his policies are very radical, and it's like a Trojan horse. He was able, I think, to garner as much support as he did because he wasn't threatening to a lot of Republicans who are triggered by people who are too loud or who are too, you know, passionate for the pro-life cause or this or that. And so they went with Josh. I hope, you know, they're responsible for what they get. He is anti-Catholic, extremely anti-Catholic, and you cannot hide that. He's only gone after the Catholic Church. He's not gone after any other organized group that has a history of pedophilia, including public high schools, coaches, some of the Orthodox religions, you know, Judaism, some of the mainline Protestant religions. I have not seen one prosecution or investigation into those groups.
Well, he's a notorious headline grabber, Christine, and he goes where the headlines are and where the zeitgeist is at any given time, because he's a very ambitious politician, very ambitious.
Yeah.
And, you know, he now jumped into the Taylor Swift ticket imbroglio, which is really a national, it's a national story. It's a national problem. But let's not forget, this man has his sights on the Oval Office, Christine.
But Danny, I mean, why is it a national problem that people can't go to see Taylor Swift's concert? Please explain to me why this is a matter of national concern, please. I just shake it off, get it? Anyway.
Well, I said it was a national problem in that it wasn't, you know, unique to Pennsylvania. People were dealing with this all over the country.
But what happened? What's the big, I mean, what happened? I don't know what happened. Did people pay their tickets and they didn't get their tickets?
It can be summed up in one word, greed. Okay? It's just a matter of greed, and these large ticket companies take over, and they are in charge of the tickets and everything else. And now this is a way, see, for the artist, the so-called quote-unquote artiste, the performer to be let off the hook. So the performer can turn this all over to Ticketmaster or Telecharge or SeatGeek or one of these organizations and then say, well, I didn't have anything to do with it. And they can charge and they come back. The organization that's handling the tickets comes back and says, well, it's purely a matter of supply and demand. It's supply and demand. This is what people are willing to pay. And so this is what we're selling the tickets for. I cannot imagine how anyone would pay $1,000, $2,000, whatever it is, in the thousands of dollars to see Taylor Swift.
I can't either. I mean, and quite frankly, is that the problem, that people are complaining because of the ticket prices? I thought people had paid for tickets that they never got or something. But if it's just because they don't like the prices.
So they had to get into some kind of lottery or line. I'm not sure of all the details. Uh-huh. And then you got a number or something, and then you had to come back. And it was very complicated. But what happened was so many people were going for tickets that then Telecharge or Ticketmaster, whoever it was, shut down the system. They shut down the system so that you couldn't get tickets at all. And of course, now he's demanding an investigation. What he should have been demanding an investigation of is what the Pennsylvania legislature, thank goodness, has already initiated, which is the impeachment of Larry Krasner. That's what he should have been demanding, an investigation of Larry Krasner, not about tickets for Taylor Swift.
I mean, this is worse than I thought it was.
Performer, teeny bopper.
Dan, I thought this was about people defrauding people and taking money and not giving them tickets. It's all about just not being able to get tickets to this stupid concert. Is that the big thing?
As far as I can tell. But
oh,
also,
Lord.
There are ticket brokers that somehow manage to game the system or crack the system and get in there and buy huge chunks of tickets, Christine, and then they resell them.
Okay, yeah, that's not right. That's not nice and everything. But for Lord's sake, an attorney general actually making almost a federal case out of this. This is embarrassing that with everything else going on, with people dying in the streets, this is what Josh Shapiro chooses to focus on. So he's upset that teeny boppers won't be able to, can you still use that term? Teeny boppers can't go see Taylor Swift, and he sues nuns. Does he do anything else? I mean, is there anything else that this man thinks is important and compelling?
I really think it's just incredible what he's gotten away with. And here's a little known fact of Pennsylvania history, Christine. He will not be the first Governor Shapiro of Pennsylvania. Did you know that?
No. Was Governor Shap a Shapiro?
Exactly.
Really? Oh,
exactly.
My gosh. Oh, wow.
Governor Milton Shap, who served as governor from 1971 to 1979, was born Milton Gerald Shapiro.
Oh, my goodness. I did
not. That was his name.
And he was my governor when I was in elementary school. I remember
Governor
Shapp.
There you are. And he was. Wow. He changed his name to Shapp, Shapp. He apparently did not change his name for politics, because you will recall, Christine, he was a very successful businessman. He followed the Donald Trump model. It followed the Trump model before Trump. He was a very successful businessman, entrepreneur, and visionary who came out of nowhere and entered politics on a campaign called The Man Against the Machine, because he wanted to clean up Pennsylvania. And he started the Gerald Corporation, which he took his middle name for the name of the corporation, which was one of the first companies to market the hardware of cable TV.
Really?
He saw the advent of cable TV long before anybody else, long before the Roberts family, okay, and Comcast, and really was a moderate
Yes.
A moderate Democrat and, yes, and a successful governor.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I remember that. And obviously, I wasn't political in 1972. I was in sixth grade. But I remember thinking, you know, OK, he's a Democrat. He's the kind of Democrat that I grew up around. Just a middle-of-the-road centrist type of person. And there are no Democrats like that left any longer. Why are all the moderates – unfortunately, in the GOP, and like the people that you noted earlier stood with Josh Shapiro. I mean, why are there no Democrat moderates?
The answer to that is very simple, because we're a big tent party, okay? And we are not a doctrinaire party, and we are not dogmatic, okay? We are not a dogmatic party. And so we are a Big Ten party, and we have that. That's why we have so much fighting in the Republican Party in so many spots, because we are a Big Ten party, and we have all different kinds of people in our party. And in the Democratic Party, you have to toe the line or you're thrown out. It's very simple. You have to adhere to the dogma of the party.
Yeah, and exactly.
The other thing I think is interesting, Christine, is that the Democrats in embracing Josh Shapiro from the outset, basically coronated a middle-aged white man as their governor and another white man as their senator. This is the party that talks so much about black and brown people, okay? But they went and they not just nominated and elected, they virtually coronated.
You make a good point. And I got very angry at people during the campaign with respect to Mehmet Oz. There were criticisms that people were making, you know, he's a carpetbagger, this and that, you know, snake oil salesman. Okay, I disagree with both of those things, but, you know, that's fair game if you want. What was not fair game was, and this was even some Republicans were doing this, some conservatives, and it got me furious. They were attacking the fact that he was a dual citizen of Turkey and the United States. They were criticizing him. They were questioning his loyalty. They were attacking his immigrant relatives, his heritage. And this, to me, is the rankest form of xenophobia that I saw mostly on the left. I saw it, but I saw it on the right too. And I called it out, and there were people who were like, well, I don't trust the man. You know what? He should only be an American. You know what? I know a lot of dual citizens, and they have absolute loyalty to this country. So you're absolutely right, Danny. You're absolutely right. They went after an immigrant. They went after the first generation son of immigrants, and they went after him because he was a Muslim as well. I mean, the attack ads against this
terrible
man. And then when I came out and noted it, people were like, oh, we didn't do that. And then when I, you know, retweeted tweets about it, oh, well, just one or two people, that doesn't represent us. Well, yeah, I can't tweet all the millions of tweets out there about it, but it's ridiculous.
And sadly, I think there were some people who called themselves Republicans, and no small amount of people who called themselves independents in Pennsylvania who bought this. And in the process, I think Pennsylvania showed to the rest of the country just how provincial and, dare I say, ignorant they are.
Yep,
okay?
We are. We is. We is provincial. We is. Yes, we are, Dan. I'm disgusted. Yes. Disgusted with this Commonwealth. I am disgusted. That senator does not represent me. That governor, or that senator-elect, doesn't represent me. That governor-elect doesn't represent me. You and I had that conversation on the eve of the election. And remember when I broke down in tears?
Yes. I do. I think you, I sensed that you were so upset, Christine, because I sensed that evening that you saw this coming. you saw this something, some instinct that you have, whatever, told you that this was going to happen. I was more confident. I thought Shapiro was going to win. That to me was not even, that was a given. But as for Fetterman, I really thought that Oz had gained on him and had inched into the lead. And I was, when it, not only that Fetterman won, but that it was called so early, it happened so quickly. And if you go back and look at the state, Christine, and where Fetterman won, you will see that Fetterman won in some of those Trump areas, some of those hard scrabble areas of the state that he should not have won, where there were presumably a big support for Trump. And that should tell you something as well about what he tapped into. He ran a nasty campaign. And he himself, of course, was hiding, but particularly on social media, he ran one of the meanest, down and dirtiest, nasty campaigns that I've ever seen.
He was
and
vicious.
Like you said, I mean, as an Italian American, I know Italian American people that have dual citizenship. They weren't born in Italy, but Italy actually welcomes dual citizenship. You can go online, you can find out if you have Italian ancestry how to become a dual citizen, and you can apply for it. In fact, when we were just traveling through Italy, my wife and I, our tour guide there was a dual American and Italian citizen.
Absolutely.
And so what? I mean,
exactly. It's a sign of respect for your heritage. It has nothing to do with your loyalty to the United States. Fetterman's camp was just, they were bigoted. They were misogynistic to the max. They were just horrific people. I mean, there are people like, well, you know, political opponents and kumbaya afterwards. No. I have no time, tolerance, or desire to cooperate with anyone who voted for John Fetterman. And I said that on my Facebook page. And I've actually unfriended people because of that. Mm. And I normally don't do that. I mean, I don't do that, Danny. I'm not that kind of person. But in voting for a debilitated man with hostile animus toward anyone who doesn't think the way that he does, in voting for him, they've basically said to me, okay, there's no common ground here. We have nothing in common. You know, why should I interact with you? And so, you know,
I think that Pennsylvania had a marvelous opportunity. They blew a marvelous opportunity. Had Oz been elected, he would have been one of the shrewdest, smartest people on the floor of the United States Senate, and he would have worked his ass off for Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Yeah, and now we have an invalid. But you know what? Guess what, Danny? I'm looking in 2 years from now, we need to get rid of the not pro-life Bob Casey. We need to fight, and we need to start doing our deep research into getting a candidate strong enough to oppose Casey, because we cannot survive as a state with two Democrats in D.C. as senators. We cannot. So that's my next campaign and crusade. Get rid of Bob Casey any way we possibly can, obviously legally, obviously politically, but we need to get rid of him. He cannot remain in office. He is an embarrassment to the state. He's a rank embarrassment to his family, his tradition, his heritage. He is so clearly and obviously pro-abortion, and he's just a disgrace, a rank disgrace. Plus, he never helped me when I reached out to him for Afghan refugees a year and a half ago. Guess who helped me? Pat Toomey. His office jumped to action right away. Casey was missing in action, did absolutely nothing. Useless, useless man. Anyway, Danny, we are up against the clock. I love talking to you. Happy Thanksgiving. Give my love to Carol and the kids. Don't get sick on turkey. And we'll be talking soon.
Thank you, Christine. Love to you, too. Have a great holiday.
This is Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Now with Philadelphia's Morning Answer, here's Chris DeGaulle.
And welcome back. And it is Chris, but it is not Chris DeGaulle. It is Chris Flowers, Christine Flowers, sitting in for the great DeGaulle, who will be back with you next week, obviously. Is Chris going to be back on Friday, Eddie? Or is it Monday?
So we're going to do a best of Thanksgiving and Black Friday, and then Chris will be live at the mic Monday at 6.
All right. Well, I'm always honored when I have an opportunity to come in and sit behind this microphone, because he really is he's the gold standard in radio, not just locally. We're very lucky to have him here, but nationally. And he's just such a smart man. I don't say that because he lets me sub for him. I say that because I listen to him every morning, and he's got his great sidekick over here, Eddie, who does yeoman's work. I mean, you guys aren't in the studio. You don't know what he does, but sort of like Chris is the brilliant tip of the iceberg, and Eddie is the part that's underground, and you see all of the solid substance. So anyway, but you know what you're getting, because you're out there and you're listening every morning. I am really happy to have – I've had some wonderful guests this morning, and I have yet another one, another Chris, by the way. My friend Chris Tremolier, who is a columnist for the Washington Examiner, a proud cum laude graduate from the University of Pennsylvania. He's a great thinker, and I wanted to have him on to talk about a bunch of things, but I think – you know, I'm going to welcome him in 2 seconds, but I think it's fabulous to have him on now as a segue to what Dan Cerucci and I were talking about, and that is the quality of the candidates that the people of Pennsylvania have elected to higher statewide office. Chris, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming on this morning.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Christine. Nice to be on with you. And I agree 100% of everything you said about Eddie.
Isn't he amazing? He's amazing.
Absolutely.
Thank you, guys.
Well, I mean, it's not just because we're all Italian. It's we yeah. love you. No,
that's part of it.
He is amazing. I'm reading an article that you wrote, Chris, which I found fascinating, entitled "Why Are Democrats Able to Win Elections with Poor Quality Candidates?" And your last paragraph, I think, is prophetic. And I'm going to read it, and then I want you to address it in light of what just happened in the midterms. Chris writes, "Decades of left-wing indoctrination in schools, colleges, the media, and the culture have altered the political landscape. Nearly half the voting population doesn't subscribe to Republican beliefs or values, especially young voters, the demographic that saved Democrats from a red wave. Beliefs and ideologies will continue to be more important than a candidate's perceived quality, especially for the left." And in your piece, you address Elizabeth Warren and AOC and really their lack of qualifications. And yet the fact that AOC was just reelected, that Warren is going to be reelected. You know, she could have that seat for as long as she wants. Maxine Waters, just the mediocrity of a candidate no longer seems to be a guarantee for their defeat. Can you address that in a little bit more detail in light of what just happened in Pennsylvania?
Sure. So I basically was listening to everyone say Republicans didn't have the red wave as expected because there were so many bad candidates running. And they were, you know, it was basically kind of a slight at the so-called MAGA candidates and, you know, candidates that President Trump endorsed. And I kind of took an issue with that because I was looking at this whole thing as, if candidate quality really mattered as much as these experts said it did, then how come, you know, all these people on the left could get elected so much? As you read, it's basically because this is what our culture is believed. Like the things that these poor quality candidates advocating for on their political platforms, these are the things that at least, you know, half of the voting population, unfortunately, believes in now. So when they have candidates who come out against abortion or pro-choice, they vilify, you know, pro-life candidates as, you know, taking away, you know, a woman's rights. And it's not viewed as killing a child, per se, because that's not what the country believes. They've been taught for decades now that, you know, such things as abortion is literally going out and taking away a woman's right to choose or the right to her body, rather than the narrative being you're killing a child. And that's a huge issue with Republicans now, as we just saw, but also going forward. It's a reason why, you know, someone like John Fetterman, I mean, for all the things you could say about Mehmet Oz, you know, I think the main thing was that he was a carpetbagger. That really didn't stop, you know, people from voting for Hillary as a senator, you know. But if you want to use that as a criticism, he was comparing the qualifications between him and Fetterman, it should be a no-brainer. You have an Ivy League educated doctor, surgeon, you know, compared to John Fetterman, who couldn't even get, you know, complete sentences out. And this was even beyond it if you looked at even some of his campaign commercials. So I think that was kind of the whole, you know, candidate quality was in reality a scapegoat was happening.
There's also a double standard too, Chris. I mean, look at, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, look at what's happening with Herschel Walker. Granted, Herschel is maybe not the most qualified candidate. However, he's not the idiot that the media are trying to make him out to be. Plus, there's a very obvious level of racism involved in the criticism against Herschel. And yet, if you tried that with any Democratic candidate, whether it be because of their gender or their race or their sexual orientation or their national origin, you would be labeled a racist, a bigot. And yet they get away with it when it's somebody like Herschel Walker. So, I mean, the double standard is glaring when I look at the way that candidates are treated based upon their ideologies and their party affiliation.
Absolutely. And that's been true of Herschel Walker, which we were saying about. It's been true of nearly every black Republican conservative who runs for office.
Yeah.
They use all the things that they say are like, no, you're not supposed to be saying this is wrong. Any ism they want to throw out there that defends them doesn't really apply when the candidate is a black Republican running for office. And Herschel Walker is just one example. So, to the larger issue, there has to be some things Republicans have to do on the culture front, because, you know, they're going to keep on having these things where, you know, oh, the supposed red wave didn't happen, and they're going to find some issue to blame, when in reality it's kind of, you know, the complacency that Republicans had in the culture for years. It's kind of chickens are kind of coming home to roost, so to speak.
Yeah, and it is a scary thing that Gen Z did come out in such full force for Democrats. That's something that, I mean, you know, we talk about the declining birth rate. Well, apparently it didn't decline enough, because there were enough Gen Zers out there who were able to essentially change the course of the election. And I think a lot of them, I don't think brainwashing is too much of a stretch to use that term, because children, earlier on in the show, I had Emerald Robinson on, and we were talking about the difference between Republicans, not so much Republicans, conservatives and progressives. And progressives look at the country as, what can you do for me? Not what can I do for you? Not what can I give you? Exactly. Not how can I contribute? Conservatives look at it as, thank God I'm here. I'm blessed to be here. This is the best country in the world. What can I do to maintain the greatness of the, you know, the whole idea of make America great again. I took issue with that slogan that Trump had. I know what he meant, but I think America's always been great. It's flawed, but we don't need to make it great again. It has remained great throughout, you know, albeit with the flaws. And you know, the whole modus operandi of liberals is to criticize. And by the way, my hand is out. Give me something. And it's very frustrating to see that that's now been sort of grafted onto the thought processes of a lot of young people. And I don't know. Do you think there's a way that we can turn this around?
I do. I think it's going to take a lot of work. And what you were saying is actually kind of a good point in about the whole Republicans, Democrats wanting to do for your country. I mean, if you think of one of John F. Kennedy's famous quotes of, you know, ask not what you can do for your country, or ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, that doesn't ring true to any Democrats nowadays at all, especially in the younger generation. So I think we're in the midst of a huge culture war, obviously, and we're kind of lagging behind. So it's going to take a lot of work, but it's something that can turn around. Obviously, if the left took over the culture, it can actually go back again. It's going to take, you know, a lot of efforts, a lot of work, and you got to do things to change the culture around to basically these people realize and their country realize all these things, like, you know, capitalism is good, you know, killing babies is bad, drag queen story hour shouldn't be happening. Those,
yeah,
that for the longest time the Republicans really wanted nothing to do with, and they got to get back to it.
Do you think it's going to take someone like, you know, another charismatic character, like for me it was Ronald Reagan. I'm a Reagan baby. I came of age politically when he, you know, entered the White House, and that had a revolutionary impact, not just on me but on people of my generation, the late boomer, early Gen X. And I think a lot of us were oriented. I think a lot of the conservative leaders today arise out of that generation, you know, that we really had someone who embodied. We also had at the same time John Paul II, and we had Margaret Thatcher. We had that great trinity, that triad of strong conservative international figures. And I'm looking today to see, who do we have who really represents those, you know, who's not polarizing, let's say, like Donald Trump, who's not, you know, localized like Ron DeSantis is. I mean, he's a great, great character, great figure, but he's really only been tested in Florida. So, you know, we'll see how he does nationwide. I mean, who do we have today that we can look to? The liberals don't have anybody, I don't think, that's really a charismatic, galvanizing character. You know, AOC doesn't cut the mustard. But who do we have? Can you give me a name of anybody that you think would really be able to sort of rally the troops?
That's a great question. And I would also actually say, when you're talking about the liberals, I think liberals had Obama. I think Obama was to liberals and current progressives what Reagan was to conservatives. But going forward, I think that DeSantis is governor, so obviously you want that regionalized. But the attacks that the mainstream media and the left did against Trump, they're going to throw right back if he should become their front runner. Like, everything they were saying about Trump, they're going to, you know, throw at DeSantis. And that's what a lot of people that kind of like were on the Republican side, or the so-called never Trump Republicans, either were like completely unaware or ignored, that it's like every time a character ever. I mean, you could even go back to Mitt Romney in 2012 and the things that they were saying about him, and, you know, he was this out of touch, you know, he was a misogynist because his binder's full of women, and he was a racist and all this. It's the same old playbook. So going forward, I think DeSantis could be. I think Glenn Youngkin could be in Virginia. I would say they're probably the two. I think you can probably get something with Nikki Haley and maybe Kristi Noem becoming, although I'm not the biggest fan of those two. Could be weapons in trying to change the culture war. I think one of the good things that might have come from this past election, if everything was true, was that there were so many, as far as shaping the culture, a lot of school boards went Republican, and that did kind of get broadcast. I don't know overall how. There seemed to be some school board candidates that were becoming one that were Republicans that won elections, and then that's something I think that, and if it was around the country, it would be better, but wherever that happened, because that kind of like sets up the foundation and builds the foundation of what kids are learning in school. could potentially, you know, have the pendulum swing back towards the right, so to speak.
Yeah,
so
no, it's very true. Education is the key. It's sort of like, you
indeed,
know,
yeah,
the hand that rocks the cradle and the hand that holds the chalk rules the world. So, and I used to be a teacher. I was a school teacher for years, and I absolutely see how important it is, because kids look at their teachers. They respect their teachers. Teachers have an amazing amount of influence. And if you can get them at an early age and inculcate in them values and principles and philosophies that are solid and whole and pro-American, it's really important. And I went to Catholic girls' school all of my life. And I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who was in my class at Mary and Mercy back in 17. I graduated in 1979. And We still have reverence for teachers that we remember. And we were fortunate in that they were teaching us wholesome values and not some of the things that are being taught today. Chris, we're up against a clock here. I love your work. I love reading your work at the Washington Examiner. You're a great writer. I love talking to you. Where can people access your work if they want to read more of your stuff?
They can go to my Twitter. It's at CWTREMO.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Wish a happy Thanksgiving to your dad, too. And hopefully I'll talk to you in the future. Be well.
Will do. Thank you very much. And happy Thanksgiving to you, your family, and happy Thanksgiving, Eddie.
Do you hear that, Eddie?
You too, brother.
Take care. Take care, Chris.
Now, more of Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
So, this is Christine Flowers making her sign off. I am grateful for many things. One of them is the friendship that I have with Eddie Caiazzo. One of them is the confidence that the great Chris DeGaulle, who I deeply admire, places in me in allowing me to sit in his seat for a couple of hours. One is the ability to talk to an audience that is incredibly well-informed and has great heart. One is my ability to bring good friends on to talk to me, people that you listened to this morning. And just the fact that I'm alive. Many members of my family did not make it to my age that I am right now. And so I'm very grateful for every day. God bless all of you. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving with your families, and I'll see you soon. I hope. This is Christine Flowers saying happy Thanksgiving.
Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer. WNTP Philadelphia, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM.